This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. White, black, cisgender, coastal elite, racist, bigot, snowflake, redneck. These labels can sometimes help us feel like we understand our world, but some of them are rarely well received from whoever we consider the other. We've asked you if you've dealt with labels recently. Here's some of what a few of you left in our inbox.
My name is Robert Barker. I currently live in Louisville, Kentucky. When people on the left find out that I voted for Donald Trump, I'm automatically labeled and identified as a homophobe, a racist, a bigot. I find that hurtful and just downright wrong.
Monica from Michigan. When Hillary Clinton called everyone who didn't agree with her deplorable, that stunk. Just because I don't agree with you doesn't mean I'm a homophobe and a xenophobe.
Paul from St. Paul, Minnesota. I moved to the big city from a small college in a very rural area. And when I got down here, I got some of the terms you might hear, hayseed, hick, that kind of thing. And I got it more subtly from other people. I did find myself having to work really, really hard to show people that I was better than them and deserved the promotion. And it did, in fact, give me an icy ball of rage in my chest that motivated me for a nice long time. It's been a blessing and a curse.
Paul, Monica, and Robert, thank you for sharing your stories. We welcome more of your stories as the hour goes on, especially because the 2016 election left many of us wounded. Labeling was one culprit. We'd love to hear from you, your questions and stories about dealing with labels. Email 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. So how do we break this us versus them mentality, especially these days? And for that matter, do we want to break it? Or are we afraid to peel those labels back and see the person underneath? Joining us from Hawaii is Irshad Manji, the founder of the Moral Courage Project. She's also the author of the new book, Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. Irshad, welcome to 1A.
Joshua, thank you for having me. And I must tell you, I love the question that you asked right off the top. Do we even want to bust out of labeling? It's a great question that really holds us all accountable, even as we point fingers at one another.
Well, then maybe that's a good place to start, especially because the genesis of this book came as a result of your work, not just trying to get people to either peel back or tear off those labels, but also with a bit of what you kind of describe as a sort of world weariness, a kind of a battle fatigue with constantly trying to get people to be willing to peel those labels back. Talk about the place you were in personally when the book began to come about.
Yeah, I was more than world weary. I frankly had endured a health crisis that was actually the beginning of this book. I have been fighting and writing about identity for more than 25 years now. And, you know, the word, I pay close attention to the language that you're using because I think you're articulating the complicated nature of this very well. You say, and I accept the premise behind this, that I got tired of getting people to do something I wanted them to do. And what I have learned over my many years of writing and fighting is that you can't get people to do what you want them to do. You can motivate them. You can encourage them. You can role model the possibilities, but you can't force people, and you certainly cannot insult and berate them into seeing you as a human being if they themselves are not treated like human beings by you. And that is one of the key points that I try to make in Don't Label Me.
I'd like to get into a little bit of your background before we get into the book. You've been at this work for quite some time. You've been involved with a program called the Moral Courage Project. You've written a number of books about Islam, trying to kind of change people's minds about the nature of Islam as a religious tradition that encourages questioning and inquiry. I remember you from Toronto, because you did a show on a network called City TV called Queer Television, which was a magazine show about LGBT people at a time when calling someone queer on television was a little bit of a shock back in 1999 and 2000. So you've kind of had skin in this game for quite some time. What is it about these kinds of conversations about such difficult subjects that attracted you?
Wow, that's a big one. I remember being asked many, many years ago, what you know, really gets to me, what bothers me about the way, you know, human beings operate. And I used two words, exploitation and hypocrisy. And I think it's because I am in some ways angered, and in other ways, I have this fire burning under me because we human beings are constantly exploiting one another by shoving each other into boxes, and into boxes that are really, you know, there for our convenience. In other words, Joshua, I don't know you at all except by dint of this interview, but if I throw some labels on you, it's my way of saying that, you know, I don't really need to see all of who you are. I don't need to engage with you. I can just write you off, and that's for my convenience. And so I will use you for that purpose. And at the same time, I will, you know, cry and whine about other people doing that kind of thing to me. And you can see that exploitation and hypocrisy go hand in hand, particularly in this era of hyperpolarization. We love to point fingers, but we really are not great at turning the mirror on ourselves. And I'm trying to, you know, convince people to do this in the book, which is to ask ourselves, even as we finger other people as the problem, to ask ourselves, how am I contributing to the very problem of labeling, of limiting, you know, one another, even as I decry it? How am I a part of what I claim to oppose?
One of the other things this book focuses on is not just labeling, but once you get past the labels, if you can get past the labels, the way that we talk about our differences. And we've gotten a number of comments from our listeners about that. Stephen wrote on our Facebook page, "I often find myself afraid to ask honest questions because I fear that I will be scolded for asking something without knowing what the current acceptable line of liberal thinking is. In social media culture, everyone is expected to be this completely well-informed person who knows what the correct opinions are. Otherwise, you can expect a quick lashing for asking a question that isn't in line with this thinking. I understand people are tired, though, of answering seemingly obvious questions. It's tiresome being in the minority and constantly being subjected to that. Plus, it's hard to distinguish when someone is asking because they're trolling or because they earnestly want to learn more. But when I ask a question, it would just be nice if I could be given the benefit of the doubt and that it's seen that my intentions are to learn." Lots to unpack from that, but one of the things that I take from that that he points to are two things. Are the acceptable line of liberal thinking, because the book does in large part speak to liberals and progressives, and also the nature of social media. Those are two of the big axes around which the book hinges.
Yeah, well, Stephen has, in his Facebook post, just nailed all of the thorny issues that are part and parcel of any honest conversation about diversity, about inclusion. I often hear, Joshua, from my own students. I'm, you know, an educator myself, and I hear from my own students that it is not my job, as in their job, to educate. Therefore, I don't want people constantly coming to me asking questions about what it is like being African American, or why, for example, blackface, you know, is so offensive, or why, you know, we are some of us are demanding reparations, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, I often ask my students, "Do you want change?" And to a person, they say, "Well, yeah, of course." And I say, "Well, then, I hate to tell you, but it is your job to educate, because nobody gets educated by being reprimanded for having questions. Now, if you're too tired to answer questions, fine. You can say, listen, you know, it's my hour off. Thanks for understanding. And just encasing that reply in the thanks for understanding goes to show that you're not trying to shame or blame anybody. You genuinely are exhausted at this moment, and there may be an opportunity for a conversation revolving around their question at a later time. But it doesn't mean that you roll your eyes and walk away. It doesn't mean that you snap your fingers and make people, genuinely interested people who could be allies in the cause for justice, don't alienate them, by deciding that they're not worth engaging. Because then you're really leaving change on the table. And in that case, we have nobody but ourselves to blame for why progress isn't happening faster.
And I want to talk to you more about how we work through that as we continue our conversation with Irshad Manji. The new book is called Don't Label Me. With regards to that deplorables comment earlier, Lita tweeted, Monica mischaracterized what HRC said, Hillary Rodham Clinton. I'm disappointed it wasn't stated that Ms. Clinton did not call everyone who disagreed with her deplorable. And Andy tweeted, okay, Hillary never said anyone who disagrees with me is deplorable. One label that applies for most Trump voters is misinformed. We'll talk about how we work through some of these labels when we continue our conversation. We welcome more of your questions and stories. And I want to hear more about one of the main characters in this book, which is Irshad's late dog and the role that she played in getting it written. I'm Joshua Johnson, and feel free to label me as the host of 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We are speaking to Irshad Manji and discussing her new book, Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. She's also the founder of the Moral Courage Project. We'd love to hear from you. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let me get to a few of your comments before we continue. AC tweeted, I am an out and proud gay socialist who is a prison abolitionist and a capitalism abolitionist. I am more than happy with people labeling me and calling me radical and a far left commie. I take all labels in stride. I'm proud of who I am and what I stand for. Irshad, what about that? Some of us like our labels. Some of us, especially LGBT people, have learned to embrace our labels. Even, a show like Queer Television takes a label that has been used to great harm and to basically tell people that's the person to go beat up. And it's made it something that you can talk about on television.
Absolutely. And I acknowledge in my book that, labels can be ennobling when we choose them for ourselves. I myself, have no problem with identifying as Muslim, as queer, as a feminist. There are any number of labels that are accurate as far as my own philosophy goes. But the problem with labels is that they always come with baggage. And that baggage is not something that I have chosen or that you have chosen. This is baggage that society chooses. And so you can certainly, use labels as a starting point to begin conversations about why you embrace the label or why you're so much more than that label implies. What I'm suggesting, though, is that we not use those labels as finish lines, meaning that because somebody is a, pinko commie or a raging socialist, that we then decide, I have nothing to learn from that person. Instead, let's ask that person, particularly if you disagree with him or her, why they believe what they believe and how they've come to that conclusion. If only because you think you're right and they're wrong, well, you're going to learn by asking them questions what their values are. And with those values, you can reframe your own points in a way that they can hear. So you see, Joshua, I am not for a minute advocating that we be polite or nice for the sake of civility. What I'm saying is, if you really want to be effective in the pursuit of social change, whatever the perspective you come from, it is in your enlightened self-interest to move beyond labels and actually learn about the very people that you've decided have a particular tag.
Can I tell you one label that I'm trying very hard to subvert through my work?
Sure.
And it's one that it makes me crazy, but the one that I'm really trying to redefine, NPR listener. I think that label has so much baggage with it, and I meet so many people who are like, we have to think about the NPR listener, or we don't want to turn off the NPR listener, or people who say, even I'm an NPR listener, as if they don't belong here. It's almost like labels that can be, complimentary as well as pejorative can be problematic because they create these pat definitions that we use to define who you are. Oh, well, if you're an NPR listener, you're white, wealthy, and well-educated.
Exactly.
Okay, that may
That's
be a plurality, but,
about.
You're also the immigrant who's learning to speak standard American English. You're also the truck driver who listens because you can hear a consistent quality of programming across the country. You're also the 30-something who's just turned on the news and found 1A as a podcast. Like, it kind of cuts for positive and negative labels. It's equally problematic, at least in my experience.
No, and in my experience as well. And, the problem ultimately with labels is that they fix people in place and freeze people in time as if that's all they are. And the fact of the matter is that as sentient beings, you and I and all living creatures are constantly evolving. So stick labels on things, they are inert and static. A door is a door. It can be used for many things, but a door is a door. But a human being or even a dog is more than meets the eye.
Yeah, let's talk about that dog, because your book, Don't Label Me, is a conversation between you and your dear departed dog, Lily, who is a blind rescue dog who is absolutely adorable. What made you decide to do this book as a conversation? Some people would say that is the sign, Irshad, that you are tripping, that you need to just take a long nap and not write about or talk to anybody about anything. Why is this a conversation between you and Lily?
Because I didn't want it to become a rant. First and foremost, the world has enough dogma, though not enough rescue dogs, but enough dogma. So that's number
well played.
One. Yeah, thank you. The second reason is that, in the book, I am equipping my readers to have honest conversations with people with whom they passionately disagree on any given issue. And so I wanted to role model that conversation in the way that I wrote the book. And so, Josh, I think it's worthwhile to tell our listeners right now that Lily isn't there to be sweet and cuddly and cute. In fact, in real life, Lily was sassy as all get out. She was blind, she was old, and yet she was the most independent thinking being you've ever had the pleasure and sometimes the displeasure of hanging around with. Lily really plays the role in this book as the person or the being who challenges me at every turn. And she reminds me that I don't have all the answers, that for all of my passion, I should be careful about how solid my convictions are, and that I should remain open to other beings' point of view, including hers. And I guess, the final point to make about why a conversation with my dog, I wanted to make this book relatable. And that word relatable is part of a bigger word, relationship. We in this society in 2019 are too steeped in transaction, in what can I get from the other person? How can I use the other, being for my advantage? And we have lost the art of relationship, of simply empathizing, of putting ourselves in the shoes of the other, including the other whom we may ideologically or politically despise, And we've decided that since we have, whoever we are, we have the answers, everybody else is either insidious or ignorant or both. Lily goes to show that, sure, labels can be, again, factual. Somebody can be blind. Somebody can be old. Somebody can even be a racist or a bigot. But that doesn't mean that that's all there is to them. And it certainly doesn't mean that we can't grow from understanding how they are the way they are, what brought them to this, you know, position in life, and what can we do to ensure that the very people who we oppose, that we're not contributing to the recruitment of more such folks. Again, so, it, you know, listening doesn't mean agreeing with.
Right.
It means creating a space in which others can be heard. And that is so crucial, Joshua, because it's only when others feel heard that they, in turn, will give you a hearing. That is the ironclad law of human psychology.
If I could kind of branch off of that in terms of, you know, your kind of dialectic with Lily, this is a theme that's come up in your books and in your work in the past. In some of your writing and your speaking about Islam and your relationship with Islam, you talk about, and I hope I pronounced this correctly, you talk about this concept called ijtihad, which is this
beautiful
Islamic legal term that has to do with intellectual examination and kind of asking a question down to its bare bones to find the truth of something. And it seems like one of the challenges in all of the work that you've taken on is just getting people ready and willing to do that work of ijtihad, of being willing to inquire and listen and push back and, you know, acknowledge better arguments and cope with it. Like, that almost seems to be the crux of what makes it so hard in practice.
Well, and it is the through line in all of my work. You know, I really value the power of asking questions because they create conversations where none would have existed before. But this is the key, Joshua. It's not the power of asking gotcha questions. You know, leave that for partisan media. For us citizens, the power of asking questions is that we show our others that we're genuinely interested in where you're coming from. And what that does is it reduces the emotional defenses in people so that we can, in fact, begin to understand. Even if I disagree, I realize now your reasons for, you know, taking this position on this particular issue so that I don't immediately, you know, label you evil or, for that matter, misinformed, because I can certainly assure one of our listeners, you know, earlier today who posted or said that he considers people who would otherwise be known as conservatives to be misinformed. Let me tell you, my brother, they feel the same about us. And, you know, that gets us nowhere. So the power of asking questions is really about supporting what democracy is all about from the ground up.
And by the way, speaking of asking questions, I know that this is not the kind of question asking that you were thinking of, but this whole idea of it kind of made us think of a clip from the sitcom The Office. In this brief clip, you may remember from having seen it that the boss, Michael Scott, who is played by Steve Carell, is asking his employees what their religions are. And the IT guy, Sadiq, who's played by Omi Vaidya, says this.
What are you?
Well, if you're going to reduce my identity to my religion, then I'm Sikh. But I also like hip-hop and NPR, and I'm restoring a 1967 Corvette in my spare time.
Okay. So one Sikh.
That's Steve Carell and Omi Vaidya from that clip from The Office. Well, I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Go ahead, Irshad.
Oh, I was just going to say, if you would allow me, in the book, there's one particular chapter called Diversity Day at the Office. And in fact, the second episode of the first season of The Office tackles the whole issue of how diversity itself has been reduced to this or that label. You know, we find Michael Scott outwitting, you know, a diversity consultant that is brought to the office largely to school Michael in how not to be offensive. But Michael manages to dispatch this consultant, you know, quite quickly, and then sticks labels, sticks note cards on his employees' foreheads, and they have to go around asking other employees, you know, questions that then get them to guess, you know, what your label is. It is completely absurd. It is hilarious, but it also, I think, is a biting commentary on where we're at today when we ask politely and, you know, silently to ourselves, how many African Americans do we have in this room? How many LGBT people do we have in this room? How many folks do we have who use the pronoun they? And it suggests that diversity is all about counting instead of about making all people, for that matter, including the supposedly loathed white guy, making them count. You only make people count when you engage rather than reduce.
We got some great questions about the idea that you're espousing, some interesting pushback that I want to put to you. Noelle writes, right. It's all very good to exercise some self-examination, but I can't help but feel there's a false equivalence lurking in this discussion. I do not sense the same willingness for self-examination among my conservative acquaintances. If it isn't a mutual self-examination, then isn't one side simply enabling the victim mentality of the other?
Well, you know, it's interesting that the person who asked this question uses the word if. If the other side is not willing to engage, are we not enabling the empowerment of that very side? But let's focus on that word if. How do you know? Well, she says she knows that, you know, the other is not willing to engage because that's been her experience. And I validate her experience. But I wonder, has she been willing to go first in the listening department? Has she been willing to go first in asking questions? Because, again, we live in a time in which we're approaching one another with mistrust right off the bat. So somebody has to go first. And I want to address a premise in her question, which is that, you know, if I go first, then somehow I'm giving up my power and giving the other person more power, enabling them. But that is to suggest that power can only be had by one side or the other. And in this book, I go to show that that is simply not true. That when you go first in asking questions and in listening, what you're actually doing is creating the culture of the conversation. You are setting the expectations, the tone for how the other is expected to respond. That is, you know, allowing yourself to be in the driver's seat. That is claiming your power, while also empowering the other to believe that they can open up to you and not have you jump down their throat for whatever they're about to say next. So we've really got to, you know, stop, I think, viewing this world of ours in win-lose or clearly win-lose terms. Yes, politics is win-lose, but citizenship does not have to be win-lose. And indeed, when we treat it as win-lose, it often winds up being lose-lose.
I can certainly, if I may just amen what you said, that I've always believed that questions are more powerful than answers. I mean, think about what my job is as the host. Being able to ask the questions governs the conversation. So that kind of automatically puts me in the position of power. Let me get to a few quick comments. We got to pause in a minute, but I want to get to a few more comments before we do. Holly wrote on our Facebook page, people aren't just offended by everything politically speaking. People are drawing some pretty clear lines against political stances, which at their base dehumanize and marginalize others. It leads to the paradox of tolerance, which states that if a society is tolerant without limit, its ability to be tolerant is eventually seized or destroyed by the intolerant. This is a lot deeper than just getting offended. Bad Fairy hit it a lot harder on the head. Bad Fairy emailed, and we've edited this for language, hail to the no. Conservatives started this. I've been called the N-word for almost 50 years and a lesbo for over 30. I was always told to be the bigger person, meaning shut up or get a thicker skin. Now they don't like labels, so we're not supposed to use them? They can have every damn seat in Madison Square Garden. They built this bed and furnished it with hate. If they don't like being the objects of it, they can be the bigger people and get thicker skins. I think Bad Fairy's coming from a very honest place. We've got a lot of comments from people saying, Damn it, no. It's not my job. You have beaten us up for generations, and it's about time either you knew what it felt like or you did your own work. Why should people who are used to being labeled do the hard work of peeling the labels off? We'll get to that in a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Irshad Manji. Her book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times, and she is also the founder of the Moral Courage Project. Irshad, we've gotten a lot of messages from people who are pointing squarely to conservatives for not only starting this problem, but fomenting it. Mike writes, I really struggle with wanting to get to know others who voted for a guy who demeaned John McCain, a real war hero, called his daughter a hot piece on the Howard Stern show, bragged about grabbing women, said that there are some good people among those in Charlottesville who screamed obscenities about Jews, admires thugs, Putin, Kim, the Hungarian leader Viktor Orban, etc. I could go on. Why should liberals bother to reach out to conservatives, especially those who voted for Donald Trump?
Because they themselves are not Donald Trump, the supporters. And yes, I understand. Believe me, I understand. Or as Donald Trump would say, believe me, that this man, as I say in my book, is vulgar, is stupid in many ways, and is a threat, a danger to democracy both here and abroad. But that doesn't mean that every supporter of his endorses all that about him. In other words, as I have engaged more and more supporters of Donald Trump, I've come to appreciate something that I don't think we on the liberal progressive side of the spectrum appreciate as much as we need to, which is that many people voted for him and will still vote for him because they dislike our humiliation of them more than they like Donald Trump. For the last 20, 30 years, those of us on the liberal progressive side have been hurling labels such as racist and misogynist and homophobe and transphobe and xenophobe at people in the heartland, for example, whom we don't even know. And because we have so much power in American culture and we use it so poorly, many of these folks say, you know, why should we care about the character of our president when you yourselves, liberals, you yourselves are violating the very sort of cornerstone of the Civil Rights Covenant, which is judged by the content of character, not by the color of skin. In other words, if I in the heartland am going to be automatically called a white supremacist because I'm voting for Trump, then that goes to show that you are the ones who are violating the judge by the content of character and not by the color of skin. And since you're going to be violating that, then Why should I care about my president's character? So my point here is this. You can roll your eyes. You can, you know, shrug your shoulders. You can wave your hand and you know, huff away. But if we're not willing to address the humiliation that many in the heartland and elsewhere feel because of the way we liberals have been using our power in the culture, if we're not willing to look at that and do something about it, then all we're going to wind up doing is paying back the toxic brew that we have been given. And here's the question I want to ask, you know, my skeptics. How does payback amount to progress? How?
It's interesting you bring up this because we also have heard some of the Democratic presidential candidates talking about the way we talk about one another. Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, gave a keynote speech at the Human Rights Campaign's fundraising event this week, and some of his comments are being reported as kind of edgy or risky as he takes on identity politics, kind of claiming that we have a belonging crisis in this country and that the Democratic Party has a hand in that. Here is part of what Mayor Buttigieg said to the Human Rights Campaign.
It is true that each of us could see in our own identity all the reasons we're misunderstood and then say, you don't understand me because you haven't walked in my shoes. Something that is true as far as it goes, but it doesn't get us very far. I may be a part of the LGBTQ community, but being a gay man doesn't even tell me what it's like to be a trans woman of color in that same community. Let alone an undocumented mother of four, or a disabled veteran, or a displaced auto worker. What I worry about are the very real walls being put up between us as we get divided and carved up. Walls going up within the working class, within communities, even within families. And what every gay person has in common with every excluded person of any kind is knowing what it's like to see a wall between you and the rest of the world and wonder what it's like on the other side. I am not just like you. No two of us are alike. But each of us has a story that can either separate us or connect us to those around us.
That was South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg speaking at a fundraiser for the Human Rights Campaign. Earshad, what did you make of his comments?
I think they're incredibly wise. And I especially love that final line, that each of us has a story. Each of us has a backstory about why we believe what we believe. And that certainly is something that, you know, I've come to learn over time, not assume or pre-assign meaning to somebody's position, but to ask, tell me, how did you come up with that? And to ask it out of sincerity and not because, you know, I want to put them in their place. Let me give you a quick example. In the book, I tell the story of Derek Black, who was for many, many years an ardent white nationalist. He was going to a college and somebody outed him as the heir to the guy who created one of the most racist websites in American history. Now, Derek Black, you might think, oh, yeah, just another one of those Christian fundamentalists, you know, who has decided that anybody who's not white or not male and certainly not Christian, you know, needs to go away or be done away with. The reality is that Derek was raised as an atheist and was told that he had the facts on his side by his parents. And he was one day invited to Shabbat dinner by a fellow student who already knew him and you know, was engaged in conversation. And over the next 2 years, he was consistently invited back for Shabbat dinner. And eventually, Derek realized that not only do I not have the facts on my side, but that I have a circle of friends whom I trust to critique my point of view without critiquing my humanity. And he became today one of the most vocal anti-racist activists. When asked, you know, why did he change? How did he change? He said it's because of the respect that he was shown as a human being. And so, again, you know, if we're concerned about the evil that is lurking out there in the form of the alt-right, in the form of white supremacists, in the form of authoritarians, we've got to understand that I'm certainly not saying tolerate them, not at all. I'm saying stand up to any, you know, hate or intolerance that we encounter. But the operative question is, how do we stand up to it? Do we do so by being defensive? If so, understand that you're not actually going to be very effective. We've got to be savvier, and that means being more humane.
I know we're winding down, but I want to get to a few more comments if I can. Jeremy is in Reston, Virginia, not far from D.C. Jeremy writes, I get what your guest is trying to say. However, there are some people who are unbearable. How do you approach someone who just doesn't acknowledge basic facts? As an African-American man, there is no starting point with people who think you women and minorities need to get over it. It's not been so bad for you. Or are quick to believe Obama was a secret Muslim. Or will say maybe that policeman had a good reason to shoot that unarmed black man.
Right. So there's a lot in that comment. And, you know, if what the commenter is saying is, you know, how do you deal with somebody who's like a conspiracy theorist? Well, as I acknowledge in the book, you can't. And when you realize that they are, and maybe you don't, but I want, there's a big however here. You don't know that that's where the person is coming from unless you're first willing to engage. So yes, walk away if you have to, and sometimes you have to. Just don't walk away prematurely.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. We got a voicemail about another aspect of being labeled that speaks to something that I've heard come up among whites fairly frequently. Here is what Erica left in our inbox.
My name is Erica. I'm from Arkansas, and I've been called a racist over social media because of defending my right to be proud of my European white heritage. And I feel that I am experiencing racism because I'm being told that I shouldn't be proud of my Italian white heritage or my Irish white heritage or my German white heritage, and that I'm being judged because of the color of my skin and not because of the cultures that my people come from.
Erica, I'm really glad you shared this voicemail because, Irshad, at different times in this country's history, the definition of what we consider to be white did not include Italians, Irish, or German people. They were considered something less than white. If you were British, if you were French, you were considered white, but not if you were Italian, German, or Irish.
That's exactly right, which again goes to show that labels are fables in many cases, you know, that they are used and we use them in turn to decide what somebody is and moreover, how much worth they have. You know, people, again, from my political perspective, rightly critique the imperialism with which so many of the founders of this country were coming from. We excoriate the fact that they sliced and diced individuals into, you know, black and white, that they then stuffed those individuals into those categories, that they made up those categories and then assigned value to those categories and thereby created a hierarchy. Well, guess what? What we're doing today in the name of diversity inclusion is too often the flip side. We too are assigning worth or lack of worth. And this is what this young woman is getting to, that just by dint of being okay, yes, even proud of the fact that she comes from a particular European heritage, that somehow she is less than. She is evil and, you know, and dangerous to our society. But as the scholar Ashley Jardina has recently pointed out in some really cutting edge research that she's done, many people who are proud of being white are not arrogant about being white. That is, they embrace the fact that they come from particular parts of, you know, the European continent or that their heritage is there. But they're not saying that they're better than others because they come from it. And listen, Joshua, I will also pose this, I think, rather a difficult question for all of us who, you know, are liberals. Don't you think that multiculturalism, if it is going to be true to itself, then also needs to celebrate the cultures that do come from so-called white parts of the world? In other words, why is multiculturalism only about celebrating brown and black people? Why not also those who are not brown and black? Otherwise, it's not multiculturalism. So we can't have it both ways. What do we want? Let's decide on that, and then let's make the case for it in a way that doesn't have to be a threat.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting...
who might otherwise feel, you know, that they are being attacked.
I think that's an interesting question for people who do define themselves as liberal to think through. And it's interesting kind of seeing people at, say, cultural festivals like Irish or German or Scottish cultural festivals and the liberation it kind of gives people to say, this is my culture, come partake. It's kind of amazing to kind of watch that happen. We are almost out of time with you, but I wonder what you would say is step one for people who want to get beyond this tendency to label before we're out of time.
Sure. It's deceptively simple, but you know, work with me on this. First, when you hear something that triggers you or that makes you feel defensive, breathe. Take just one breath. And what you're doing is you're slowing down the blood rush in your body. You are taming the egoistic part of the brain so that you can, you know, override it and tap into the more evolved part of the brain that allows you to respond rather than react. And second, respond not with a statement, who the hell, you know, or you're wrong or you're an idiot. That's a statement. Respond with a question. Why do you feel that way? Where are you coming from? Tell me more about what brought you to that point of view. And when you do that, remember, you are gleaning information that with which you can then reframe your own argument in a way that the other person can finally have a shot at hearing. I repeat the ironclad law of human psychology. In order to be heard, you must first be willing to hear.
Irshad Manji, the founder of the Moral Courage Project. Her new book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. Irshad, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
This conversation was produced by Bianca Martin. To learn more about her and the rest of our staff, visit the1a.org/staff. And please do check out our podcast on the NPR One app or whatever app you'd like. We'd be honored if you'd write us a review. You'll find the links to listen at npr.org/1a. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.